This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today we'll be talking about Hugo Chavez and Venezuela. My guest is Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist who's been in Venezuela and has been writing about it for at least the past 6 years. Wilpert is the editor of a book called Coup Against Chavez in Venezuela and also Changing Venezuela that's just come out. He also edits the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. That's Venezuela, and then not another A, but just analysis.com. Gregory Wilpert, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's just start with how it happens that you got down to Venezuela. What attracted you about Venezuela?
Actually, it was at first my wife.
Well, that's as good as reason any.
She is Venezuelan, and we had to return back to Venezuela because she was here on a student visa, and I got a Fulbright grant in order to finance our return to, or our, my first visit to Venezuela.
And when was that visit, that first visit, and then you stayed there?
Yes, it was in 2000.
And was Chavez in power then?
Yes, he got elected shortly beforehand in December of 98.
And what was it like getting there? What were your first impressions?
Well, it to be honest, I actually was very skeptical and about Chavez because of his military background. And I think this has been a very universal experience for people who have been observing Venezuela. They were very skeptical about Chavez. And so I kind of took a very kind of, I should say, a very detached view of what was happening and didn't really become too involved in terms of observing the day-to-day politics as I would later become. So,
and what got your attention?
It was the coup. It was really the coup.
Did you smell it coming?
Yes, it was clear it was coming because the weeks and the couple days leading up to it, the tension was mounting and you knew that something dramatic was going to have to happen. And the only thing at that point that could have happened was a coup, really.
And what was the date of this?
Well, the coup itself happened on April 11th of 2002. And almost exactly 4 years ago. But you could tell it was coming already when they called for a general strike, which was on April 8th.
For people in Venezuela, it must have been eerily reminiscent of Chile in the overthrow of Pinochet, where people make the overthrow of Allende and the installation of Pinochet. Were people making that comparisons?
Yes, definitely. There were articles certainly in the international media that started, I think it was John Pilger who made that first comparison, and some other writers as well. And you definitely, a lot of people who were familiar with the Chilean case saw it coming because of the way the media and the Union Federation, the Old Guard Union Federation were involved. Just the kind of the constellation of forces was extremely similar.
So you were there in Caracas on April 11, 2002.
Yes, I wasn't just in Caracas. I was actually on the main bridge where the footage of Chavez supporters firing their guns, footage that was used later to justify the coup.
Well, did you see people firing their guns up there?
Yes, of course. I mean, the footage exists and was real footage, except it didn't happen exactly as the local media was claiming, and later the international media, they said that Chavez supporters were shooting at opposition demonstrators, and that was patently untrue, was a lie. I saw it. They were shooting at police officers who were shooting back at them. So it was an exchange of fire between police below the bridge and Chavez supporters above the bridge, but not between opposition demonstrators and Chavez supporters.
You must have been frightened.
Yes, definitely. Everybody went for cover, and the bridge cleared, and you could only get peeks of what is happening. It was especially scary because people were saying that there were sharpshooters in the buildings nearby, and there you couldn't really duck for cover because you didn't know where they were.
And then what transpired after that exchange of fire?
Well, the most important thing was that the media used those images to say that something was happening, that Chavez was ordered his supporters to shoot at opposition demonstrators, and that the media, military then used that as a justification to rebel against Chavez, saying that we cannot support a president who would do something like this, and therefore we no longer recognize the president. And that was then used as an excuse to arrest him eventually, all of which was false, as I saw with my own eyes at that point.
But the coup lasted only a couple days. Why did the coup fail?
Well, it failed for at least two or three reasons. The main reason, I think, was that the opposition that organized the coup overreached. That is, they had a very broad-based coalition that supported the coup, but the most right-wing elements of that coalition took control of the coup and essentially it made sure that all of its members were in the new government, in the so-called transition government. And so then more moderate factions of the military and also the unions ended up rejecting them. So that was one reason, one important reason. Another important reason, of course, was that people could see that this coup government was on shaky ground, and Chavez supporters and the military actively went out onto the streets to support and demand for Chavez's return.
It's so hard to figure out exactly what's been going on from where I sit in the United States, because I heard some anti-Chavez people saying, well, he had orchestrated the whole thing himself and just wanted to increase his popularity. There's nothing to that, though, is there?
No. I mean, that's one of the popular opposition myths, that Chavez had organized the coup himself in order to do what they call a autogolpe or self-coup, kind of like Fujimori did, in order to strengthen his power. And there's just absolutely no evidence whatsoever that that's what happened.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm talking with Gregory Wilpert, who's the author of Coup Against Chavez in Venezuela, and also a new book, Changing Venezuela. What, from your reporting and reading, has been the was the U.S. role in this coup?
Well, it's not completely clear, but the things that we do know for a fact is, first of all, that the U.S. government knew that a coup was in the works. CIA documents have come up that stated very clearly that they were informed about the coup plans, and they even outlined before it happened more or less the scenario, that opposition demonstrators would be shot at, that Chavez supporters would be blamed for that, that there would be deaths, and that that would be used as the justification. They knew all of that beforehand. So they were pretty well informed, first of all, and they didn't do anything to stop it, obviously. And the other thing that we know is that as soon as it did happen, the Bush administration, its spokespersons came out and basically supported the coup. I mean, they basically gave the coup organizers' version of events and stated it as fact and gave their unreserved backing.
They blessed the coup. The New York Times editorial blessed the coup to its embarrassment, or I hope it's embarrassed by that now. Who knows? Now, after the coup, Chavez did retain power, and then there was another attempt to have a business or community capital strike against him that failed miserably. How would you say he's doing now?
I think he's in a pretty good position. I mean, at first, when the coup happened, he was very weakened. Things were very uncertain as to which way they would go. Chavez tried to moderate his policies by putting in more moderate members of his cabinet, and basically all of his policies became more moderate. However, then after the shutdown of the oil industry in December of 2002, once that effort was defeated a couple months later, when oil production was back up to normal, Chavez knew that he'd essentially gotten rid of his most dangerous opponents, which were the opponents in the military, which were basically gotten rid of during the coup, after the coup.
Not killed, though.
No, basically removed from office. And then the oil industry is the other crucial sector for Venezuela, since it gets so much of its 50% of the government revenues come from oil. The oil industry was essentially still in the hands of people who supported the opposition. And so after the shutdown of the oil industry and after the recovery of the oil industry, Chavez was able to put his supporters there. And so having his supporters both in the military and in the oil industry allowed him then to act with much greater freedom and to radicalize his policies and to take his program much further than he ever would have been able to do. And ever since then, Chavez has essentially become for lack of a better word, more radical in many ways.
What are the elements of his program?
I would say there are two main elements. One is a more kind of traditional social democratic redistribution program. The government uses the oil revenues and increased taxes and uses basically its revenues to redistribute wealth towards the poor, mostly in the form of new social programs, a whole variety of social programs, whether involving health, education, providing subsidized food. All of this is many ways, and even now they're starting a new program, which is part of the Constitution, actually, to give allowances to homemakers. To recognize their labor as being economically productive labor. So
these are women, largely.
Yes. And so basically, so this is a redistributive program that is in many ways very normal or ordinary in the history of Western states.
What's the other element?
The other element is much more radical, I would say, because it's an effort to introduce what they're calling participatory democracy. What the government has done is to get citizens involved in all kinds of different ways in the functioning of the government. For example, all of the social programs are guided essentially by local committees. And that is, if a community wants to have a community doctor in their area, then they organize a health committee. If they want to be part of the land reform program, they organize a land committee. And then all of these policies are then organized and directed or guided by these community groups. So that's one element or one aspect of participatory democracy. Another one is the creation of institutionalizing these committees in the form of local planning councils, which would be a form of direct democracy on the most local levels, where 200 to 400 families get together to organize and determine the budgets of their community and to basically guide all of these programs that I mentioned earlier.
Now, do these changes, Greg Wilpert, do they flow from the new Constitution? You say in one of your books that he's democratized the Constitution. Though I had heard the rewriting the Constitution as something negative that he did. You put it in a positive light that it enabled this participatory democracy to take root.
Yeah, it certainly did. One of the main things that the Constitution says that Venezuela is not just a representative democracy, but also a participatory democracy. And this is something that Chavez has emphasized over and over again. And you see this in many different ways. I mean, for example, when they nominate court judges, you have civil society participation in the nomination process, or the National Electoral Council. Also, you have civil society participation in that.
But you mentioned the judges, and another criticism of Chavez, of course, is that he's packed the Supreme Court. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a part of the whole argument that the Constitution and Chavez's efforts to rewrite the rules of the country have centralized power. And certainly there's some element of truth to that. I mean, I think that in some ways the presidency, the office of the presidency has been strengthened, but not as much as most critics say. I mean, actually, if you compare the Venezuelan president to the U.S. president, I would say the power that they have is more or less equal. As a matter of fact, the Venezuelan president, by the Venezuelan Constitution, cannot appoint judges. It's only done by the National Assembly. I mean, that's just one example, whereas in the U.S., it is the president.
And while we're making comparisons, why not compare Chavez to a predecessor president in Venezuela? What does his human rights record look like in context to some of the people who preceded him?
It's actually much better, I would argue. It's true that there are many human rights problems in Venezuela, but in the history of human rights in Venezuela, it's become much better. I mean, If you look at previous human rights reports or Amnesty International reports, one of the worst periods of Venezuelan history was the presidency of Carlos Andrés Pérez, which wasn't that long ago. He was president from 1989 to 1993. And there was massive censorship. February 1989, there was a huge massacre of people because they were rioting. Anywhere between 300 and 3,000 people were killed. Massive police brutality, torture against dissidents.
And was the U.S. supporting?
And the U.S. was completely behind Carlos Andrés Pérez and never criticized anything that he did.
Well, there's a bit of an irony. I'm speaking with Greg Wilpert. He is the author of Coup Against Chavez in Venezuela and Changing Venezuela. Now, you've mentioned a lot of things on the positive side of the ledger as far as Chavez goes. I know you aren't into cult of personality, nor am I. I don't believe in romanticization of leaders. You write about his cult of personality. Explain that, discuss that at some length, and perhaps other what you call authoritarian tendencies that trouble you.
Yeah, in my book I argue that there's three main obstacles for the Chavez presidency to succeed. And one of them is the cult of personality. I would call it a latent cult of personality because I don't think it's really a full-blown cult because it's not like something that you might that we've heard about in North Korea or in Eastern Europe, the worship of Stalin or of Hitler or somebody like that. I mean, you don't see Chavez's picture on every wall. I mean, certainly like you do in the U.S. on government buildings, you know, inside offices, you see that, but not you know, in every billboard or something. It's not that common. I don't think it's really a cult of personality that the government itself is promoting necessarily. Chavez, however, not as an individual, is kind of promoting a cult of personality in the form of, for example, has a weekly television program that lasts you know, anywhere between 6 and 7 hours once a week. I mean,
what's it called again?
Alo Presidente. And it's a great program in many ways because he lays out what he's thinking, what the newest government policies are, and what basically what the government is currently doing. And I think in that sense it provides for a lot of transparency. But on the other hand, to focus a whole program almost only on him talking, certainly other people will talk, but it's almost always only him, just centralizes so much attention on the president. And so everything that the government does, there's this tendency to centralize attention on the government, on the president. And the great danger is that if Chavez were to disappear, whether it's assassinated or die of natural causes, his whole program and his whole movement would fall into pieces because there's nobody who comes even close to the level of popularity or leadership capability that Chavez has. And so that's a serious problem. Also, it makes it very difficult to criticize Chavez because he centralizes so much attention and demands such loyalty that loyalty is confused with being uncritical. And so Chavez rarely hears any criticism. So these are all elements of this kind of latent cult of personality that exists, which is, I think, a problem. There's other problems, which is the kind of a cultural authoritarianism. I don't think it's Chavez's authoritarianism, although I think he himself has these tendencies.
What is that cultural authoritarianism?
Well, for example, in Venezuela, it's considered extremely important to show respect to one's superiors. And that's fine. That's something that exists in many cultures. However, in Venezuela and in other countries in Latin America, they've tried to legislate that so that if you show disrespect for government officials, you can actually suffer a prison penalty for something like that. It's considered a crime.
I know Human Rights Watch has written very critically of this aspect.
And this is not something that is new to Venezuela, and it's not something new that is new to Chavez. This has existed before. Actually, the law that Human Rights Watch writes about and criticizes about the penalization of disrespect is something that's been on the books for 40 years before Chavez came into office. However, the Chavez government has not made an effort to get rid of it, and that's my criticism. It's not so much that it's not that Chavez has introduced this.
Has he gone beyond that, though? Has he charged people under it?
No, so far nobody has been charged with it. Only in one case, so far there's somebody under investigation for that. And it's usually more of an issue of of an individual being charged. That is, when it's a civil case, that is, a government official will have to take the case, not the state itself.
Greg Wilpert, Human Rights Watch, also accuses the Chavez government of violating freedom of the press in its dealings with the media that was terribly hostile to him and privately owned. What's your assessment of that?
Well, actually, if you look at the report carefully, I don't think it says so much that they actually have violated freedom of the press. I mean, there hasn't been any censorship or anything like that. However, their argument is essentially that that there are laws in place that that could violate freedom of the press. And I think that the danger is a little bit exaggerated. I mean, there are some elements that I disagree with, but by and large, it looks pretty much like the FCC regulations. That is, you cannot broadcast sexuality and violence during certain hours and so on. It's true that, and the problem lies with some vague wording of some of the law, so that it could be used to, for example, try to suppress violent images of some violent demonstration or something like that. But so far, none of that has happened. And the argument that the opposition and Human Rights Watch have made is that this is perhaps a chilling effect. Now, that could be, but so far I haven't seen it. I mean, the media is completely anti-Chavez, the private media, and so far they haven't held back at all. I mean, you see incredible amounts, incredibly harsh criticism of the Chavez government using whatever images that they can get.
What do you make of just the incredible polarization that there appears to be in Venezuela as regards Chavez? I have a son who's dating a Venezuelan woman who despises Chavez, says her family has been and relatives have been disadvantaged because of Chavez's policies, and that if you don't play ball with Chavez or join the party, or you know, you lose out.
Well, the polarization is something that I think Chavez has brought to the forefront. That is, the polarization in Venezuela has existed for a long time, but the middle and upper classes in Venezuela just never were aware of it. They always tended to believe that Venezuela was one big happy family, and they didn't really realize the extreme marginalization that had been going on for 20 years before Chavez came into office. Poor in Venezuela had been getting bigger, in terms of larger and larger proportion of the population had been getting poor, and polarization had been increasing dramatically in those 20 years. Chavez brought that polarization to the forefront by talking about it and by implementing policies that would benefit the poor, and thereby basically alienating the middle class and the upper class, which didn't like a president who talked like the poor and acted like the poor and then benefited with his policies the poor. And so that's so that polarization is a really a result of bringing to the forefront of polarization that was there already.
He's very popular, according to a poll I saw on your website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com, that revealed that he has 82% support.
Well, I don't know if that was solid support. It's an approval rating. So those things tend to be very volatile.
Bush would die for an 82% approval rating.
That was actually done by an opposition polling company. So it's Chavez has had that before. Shortly after he was elected, he had 90% even. However, those people who would vote for Chavez would probably be closer to 60%, which is what he got during the recall referendum.
Do you ever worry, Greg Wilpert, that progressives in the United States are romanticizing Chavez?
Well, actually, the progressives in the United States and around the world tend to be rather divided on Venezuela, and some people definitely overly romanticize Chavez and others overly demonize Chavez. So I find it very frustrating that there's very few people seem to want to make a kind of differentiated picture of what is happening and then kind of reserve support or non-support based on this differentiated picture. Rather, there's always these kind of comic pictures of who Chavez is.
What do you make of the possibility that the United States government may still be trying to overthrow Chavez? I know it's a claim that he makes repeatedly, but From my listening to the language of U.S. officials, I mean, you have Condoleezza Rice, you have Rumsfeld, you have Porter Goss of the CIA saying nasty things about Chavez. You have in the U.S. National Security Strategy document that was released in March a line that calls Chavez a demagogue awash in oil money who is undermining democracy and seeking to destabilize the region. That rhetoric usually is the rattle of the snake. You know, I'm waiting for the bite. Does that seem like it's coming, or is that an impossibility?
Well, it depends on what you mean by trying to overthrow Chavez. I think in Venezuela, people definitely believe that Chavez is going to try to, that the United States is going to try to overthrow Chavez by military means. Now, I don't think that there's any possibility of that. However, there's all kinds of covert and overt means that are currently being implemented. We know, for example, that the U.S. government, via the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID, is providing tens of millions of dollars every year to the opposition in Venezuela. And we also know for a fact that the United States, Condoleezza Rice recently actually admitted to it, saying that they're trying to organize a coalition of international, coalition of countries to oppose Chavez. Now, they haven't succeeded with that.
In fact, they failed at the Organization of American States pretty badly a few months ago on that.
However, these efforts are going to go on, and one of their best bets, if the U.S. wanted to do something dramatic, would be to assassinate Chavez or support an assassination attempt. However, I think they probably, their analysts in the CIA and so on, probably know that that would spell disaster for Venezuela and the United States, because that would plunge the country into complete chaos and would almost certainly restrict the flow of oil to the United States. So I don't think that the U.S. would be interested in assassination. More likely is that they want to delegitimize Chavez, and the best way to do that, which is on the horizon, is to try to convince the opposition to withdraw from the presidential elections this coming December.
And why do you think they're so interested in doing that? Is that because Chavez has thumbed his nose at the Bush administration foreign policy, or that he's departed from the neoliberal Washington model, or is it because he's making it harder on U.S. oil companies? What's your assessment?
I would say it's all three of those. The Bush administration is full of oil interests, and Chavez has been hitting oil interests in Venezuela quite hard. He's been the strongest opponent to U.S. foreign policy, I would say, in the world, perhaps, constantly criticizing what he's calling U.S. imperialism and imperial ambitions. And he's been very much against the free trade area of the Americas and has been instrumental, essentially, in defeating that ever got implemented, and trying to stop also U.S. economic policy in the World Trade Organization.
How has he been tough on foreign oil companies?
Well, recently, just this last week, all foreign oil companies that were doing business in Venezuela under as kind of subcontracting agreements, basically pumping the oil for Venezuela's state-owned oil company, were told that they have to create joint ventures with the oil company where they would have a minority share of only maximum 40%. In other words, the state would have a 60% ownership. Not only that, those joint ventures that already existed have to pay much more royalties and taxes than they did before. Royalties were increased from 1% to 30% and taxes from 30% to 50%.
Well, there you have it. Their profits are going to go down.
Definitely.
How much longer does Chavez have in office, or can he run again?
He's up for re-election in December of this year, 2006, and for another six-year term. Now, what Chavez has said in order to threaten and to scare the opposition is that if they boycott the elections, he would ask for a constitutional referendum to allow an indefinite number of re-elections. Right now, the Constitution limits him to one more term.
Well, I'm sure that's going to add fuel to the fire. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Gregory Wilpert, thanks for being my guest.
My pleasure.
His latest book is called Changing Venezuela. His website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.